This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Sometimes it feels as though we inhabit parallel universes simultaneously. Since the Conservatives narrowly won the Uxbridge by-election last week, having campaigned heavily against the proposed extension of London's ultra-low emission zone, there's been a slew of commentary suggesting that this casts doubt on the political viability of other green policies, notably the UK's zero carbon strategy. At almost exactly the same time, the Met Office has predicted that the sweltering record hot summer of 2022 will feel cool by the end of the century, even with the net zero target met, let alone without. So what exactly is net zero? What's the UK's strategy for meeting it? And what does it require Britons to do? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's start with the basics. What exactly is net zero and why are we signed up to it? To take us through that is Attractor Mooney, climate correspondent at the Financial Times. Attractor Mooney, let's start by explaining what the net zero target actually is.
The UK's net zero target is to be net zero emissions by 2050. And the roots of that is in the Paris Agreement from 2015, where countries agreed to limit global temperature rises to well below 2 degrees or ideally 1.5 degrees. To do that, scientists say we need to cut emissions to net zero by 2050. And net zero basically means that we reduce emissions as much as possible, such as by decarbonising our power sector. And when we can't cut those emissions anymore, then we use offsets. And that would be through planting trees or using technology like carbon capture and storage, which is a new technology. Well, it's not necessarily new, but it's not proven at scale.
So net zero is not zero emissions, carbon emissions. It is actually that they net each other out at the end of the process.
Exactly.
Now, let's be absolutely clear. The objective of net zero is to limit global warming by when?
2100. But we don't want to go past 1.5 degrees, full stop.
Let's take the start point. When is that 1.5 degrees started from?
So it's 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. So before we started pumping lots of fossil fuels and putting lots of greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere.
Why 1.5?
So after the Paris Agreement, the IPCC, which is this big group of global scientists who are experts on climate change, did a special report looking at the difference between hitting 2 degrees versus 1.5 degrees. And what they found there was that there was a really big difference between the impact of 2 degrees versus 1.5 degrees. For most of us, if we think about 1.5 degrees, it doesn't sound like a big number, but actually it's a really big deal on a global scale because we're talking about a global rise in average temperatures. The difference is, for example, at 2 degrees, we lose pretty much all coral reefs around the world. At 1.5 degrees, we keep some of them. At 2 degrees, we have much more of the population exposed to extreme temperatures. Species come under a lot more stress. And in the case of small island states, many of the low-lying islands, they say that the difference between 2 degrees and 1.5 degrees is whether they keep their homes because sea level rises.
Let's look at Britain's role in all this. Now, obviously, if we take this back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, Britain was one of the first great carbon emitters, and we've historically been a major carbon emitter, but we probably aren't one anymore. So why was it considered so important by our government for us to hit net zero?
It's important because the UK is still a major economy, and while it might not be one of the biggest emitters anymore, it still is a major economy, and what it does sets an example for the rest of the world. And the UK also has the potential to cut emissions faster than some countries, simply because it is a richer country than many other countries around the world.
Now, when did the UK introduce its net zero policy?
Theresa May did lots of work on this before she left office in 2019, making a net zero target law in 2019. Boris Johnson then popularised it, introducing kind of a bunch of policies with a more detailed strategy in 2021. And then the government was forced again this year to update that strategy earlier in the spring.
Did we have any precedents to look at, or were we kind of pioneering when we set out a strategy to reach net zero?
Setting the net zero target and enshrining it in law in 2019, the UK was the first major economy to do that. But other countries had set a similar target prior to that, but smaller countries. Of the major economies, there wasn't that much else to look at, but you would be looking at countries like Sweden, and the EU was doing lots of work on it as well.
Attractor Mooney. Much is claimed about what the public thinks about green policies and net zero, but what's the truth? The Briefing Room's Ben Carter spoke to Gemma Connor, research manager at the polling company YouGov.
Gemma, if we look at the most important issues facing the UK, where do the public rank the environment?
So currently, the environment is sitting at around fourth on our most important issues tracker, with around a quarter listing it in their top three most important issues facing the country today. The economy sits first at the moment, 64% saying that's the most important issue, followed by health and then immigration.
And do the UK public support the government's commitment to reduce carbon emissions to net zero by 2050?
Yes, so this is one of those government policies that actually has broad support across the whole demographic. So 71% of the British public support this policy of net zero by 2050, with just 16% opposing. And that is true across all different groups of people, so across their age, the gender, and even political divides. The groups that are most supportive are Londoners at 80% and Labour voters. 83% of this group are supportive of this policy. Even amongst the groups where we'd expect to see less support, a majority would still support this policy as opposed to opposing it. So these groups would be 63% of Conservative voters are supportive of the net zero target and 61% of Leave voters.
And what do we know about what people think of the way the government is handling the issue of the environment in the UK?
So a majority of Brits think that the government is doing a bad job of handling this issue at the moment. 61% saying a bad job, 27% saying a good job. Back in 2020, this gap was much narrower, but since then we've seen the gap between handling it well and handling it badly widening.
And do we know what people think about how the way the UK is handling climate change compared to other countries?
Perhaps surprisingly, given that people don't think the UK are doing a very good job of looking after the environment, people actually think we are doing more as a country than other countries. So 32% say that the UK is doing more than other countries around the world to tackle climate change, with a further 23% saying that we're doing as much as other countries are.
And I know you did some UK polling late last year about what individuals would be willing to do to address climate change. What did you find there?
Earlier this year, we found that softer changes in behaviour, such as creating green spaces in your home, reducing your meat consumption, or switching to a green energy supplier, we see higher levels of willingness to take these actions. But what we see is there's quite a strong correlation between willingness to make changes to people's lives to tackle climate change and the impact those changes would have on people's lifestyles. So those softer changes in behaviour, for example, reducing their meat consumption, 35% of Brits say that they would do this, but only 14% would take the tougher option of cutting meat out of their diet completely. Similarly, if we look at sort of cars and driving, a third of people would say they'd switch to an electric car, but only 22% would be willing to cut out driving from their life completely. So where that would be a more substantial change to their lifestyle and the way they live their life, people are less willing to make that more drastic action.
And do we know whether that's a similar picture in other countries?
So there are generally similar patterns across Europe when we look at willingness to take individual action, although there are some key areas of difference. So for example, if we look at Italy and Spain, our latest YouGov data shows that people in these two countries are much more willing to look at alternatives to petrol cars, whether that's using an electric car or actually not using cars at all when looking at walking, cycling, or using public transport. If we look at a country like Germany, actually a quarter of people saying that they're already not using a car to get about. In Italy and Spain, we also see that people are much more willing to switch to a green energy supplier than they are in other countries. But across Europe, we find that actually having to cut meat out of our diets completely or paying more for flights to cover the environmental impact are really unpopular measures, and people would not be willing to do this.
Gemma Connor. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one asking about the impact on the environment of eating meat, the one about why Britain is getting inflation so wrong, and the one about the origins and motivations of the Wagner Group. Right, it's time now to take a closer look at the UK's net zero policy and how it compares with what other countries are doing. Joining me now is Dr. Sean Fitzgerald, Director of Research for Cambridge Zero and Director of the Centre for Cambridge Climate Repair. Sean Fitzgerald, what has the UK actually done to move towards net zero since the policy was launched?
Well, they've done a few things. Certainly, government has obviously announced the phase out of the purchase of new diesel and petrol cars and vans by 2030. Secondly, we also have the initiative that was announced last year, so it came into force 1st of April 2022, regarding what we call the boiler upgrade scheme. So this is trying to decarbonise the domestic built environment, so encouraging people with a financial incentive of about £5,000 so that when they can get rid of their oil or gas boiler, they can purchase something like an electric heat pump so that we've got the opportunity to decarbonise the built environment. And then thirdly, the government has invested about £100 million in demonstrator projects to do with greenhouse gas removal projects to try and further our knowledge and figure out which schemes we might be able to use as our compensators, in other words, greenhouse gas removal, to counterbalance the fact that we're still going to be emitting things in 2050.
OK, so let's take each of those three in turn. Cars first. 2030 isn't that far away. Do you think we're going to meet that commitment of banning the sale of new petrol and diesel cars by 2030?
I mean, the government's obviously committed to that, and it is up to the legislation to be enacted and then kept in force. But as with all things, it will also require the support of the industry to do so. But the signs are, that I read anyway, are that the industry is welcoming sort of a clear indication of where we need to go in terms of strategy. And then with a long enough runway of indications of where we're going, industry is then more prepared and willing to make those sorts of investments.
Well, let me put the question in a slightly different way then. How well prepared is the infrastructure and our people for this to happen?
So that's, unfortunately, a very killer question, because although the cars might be electric, what about the infrastructure to provide the ability to charge those vehicles? If you are fortunate to have a driveway, a detached house or something like that, then OK, you can go and get an electric charge point installed in your own home. But what about all of the many other homes, apartments in places where you have on-street parking or car parks, especially the on-street parking where you can't guarantee where you're going to park? There's a lot of work that needs to be done in 7 years if we're going to be banning those vehicles for sale, at least. We've got a lot of work to do on the infrastructure and rollout throughout society.
Let me ask very quickly, are we doing that work?
There have been some signs, but really, whenever you walk around a city where I live, for example, in Cambridge, there is so much to be done in 7 years. It's going to be very difficult to see how that is going to be transformed in that kind of time period.
OK, let's talk about homes and boilers now. What are the specific plans there and how well advanced are we in meeting those?
So the specific initiatives that have been put in place are the financial incentives to allow you to sort of have a bit of pain relief, as it were, because heat pumps are considerably more expensive than a replacement oil and gas boiler. And that's a good thing. But there are two things that are important. Firstly, is what about the homes that are not well suited to an air source heat pump, for example? They require better, larger area radiators, for example. Those are not factored into the costs just in terms of replacing a boiler. If you haven't got a modern home, the upgrade for Victorian homes and things like that is really rather expensive. So we haven't got that in place. And then secondly, if you think about the decarbonisation of the built environment by 2050, the number of installers $1 million of equipment and the contractors required to do all of the work on the homes is a major undertaking. And at the moment, we don't have that in place.
How do you put that in place?
Training and also providing enough signals for the industry to go and recruit and skill up. And it's really making sure that the stability of policy is what drives companies to make future investments.
Stay with me, Sean, because I now want to bring in Frederick Hans, who's the climate policy analyst at the New Climate Institute in Germany, who's down the line from Barcelona. Frederick Hans, the UK was the first G7 country, I think, to announce a net zero policy back in 2019. How would you assess the UK's progress?
Actually, I think the UK has stagnated. The UK was indeed the first to legislate for net zero and also sort of ramp up the ambition of their 2030 target. However, this position of global leadership in that sense is really in doubt at the moment. And we saw that the UK government had to produce a new strategy in March this year, given that the old one was actually ruled unlawful, given the lack of transparency. But looking at this new strategy that is indeed way more transparent, we also see that there is really a lack in progress to implement all these policy developments that are needed. So at the moment, for instance, we and also the Independent Climate Change Committee in the UK consider that only 20% of those emission reduction needed by 2030 are actually covered by credible policy. And that is obviously too little.
We'll come back to some of that later, Frederick. But since 2019, how many other countries have followed suit in setting a net zero target? And are they introducing similar measures? And maybe you have some examples in mind.
So indeed, there is an increasing number of countries announcing net zero targets, and they do that in very different ways. So some indeed enshrine them in law, like the UK did, but then also others basically just make an announcement. But looking at these entire targets and the range of targets, at the moment, as of now, almost 90% of the global emissions are covered by such targets, and even 15% of global emissions are covered by targets that are legislated and are in law, which is a quite positive development. So for instance, very recently, we've seen Switzerland, the Swiss citizens, adopting a net zero target as law in a public referendum. And we've seen other countries following suit. However, also many countries do not do that at the moment, and they only stay at, let's say, rather vague high-level announcements that have been made, but they do not further substantiate those targets. But in general, we clearly see a trend that other countries do announce these targets and also follow up, putting them in law and policies.
Governments, of course, set these policies and they're in charge of them, but the private sector absolutely needs to buy into them, doesn't it? I mean, is that happening?
I would say yes and no. So we have seen a momentum in corporate target setting since 2019, 2020. And there are more and more companies that set these longer term net zero or carbon neutrality targets. So for example, there are over 2,000 companies that currently at least commit to the Science Based Targets Initiative's net zero standard. However, recent analysis and also our recent analysis has shown that these targets oftentimes really lack substance in what they mean. So what companies really do to transition their business model to zero or very low emissions. And what we see in addition is that despite their corporate commitments, they oftentimes still lobby against more stringent climate action. And that is obviously a contradiction. So I think it's really a mixed bag. And there's certainly also more buy-in needed going forward from the private corporate sector.
We've talked about the things that government does and the targets it sets in terms of key sectors, boilers, cars, so on. And we've talked about what companies may or may not be doing. Sean, and then Frederick, let's talk a bit about what individuals can do. 70% of people in the UK support the net zero policy. So what more could they be doing about it, Sean?
Well, the things here and now on a daily basis, there are lifestyle things, and you don't need to make very big lifestyle changes on day one. So, for example, what you eat, there are very big differences in the carbon intensity of your diet. How much red meat do you eat versus how much white meat versus, for example, are you more vegetarian? And You might think it's very difficult to sort of switch away from your current diet if you're a meat eater, red meat eater, straight to vegetarian. But in fact, there may well be a journey that you decide to at least try, which is we're going to reduce your red meat consumption. You might then switch to just white meat. And over the course of not very long, you get used to it. And then you've moved into a vegetarian arena, or very, very largely vegetarian arena. So certainly your diet, how you live, so in terms of just where you go on holiday, what vehicles do you buy, do you use, how do you use more public transport? There are lifestyle choices that can be small and they can all collectively make a big impact. But to be honest, the biggest impact one can make, which is not on a daily basis, it's on a 5-yearly basis, but it comes down to what you do at the ballot box. And therefore really thinking about sort of what can we do collectively as a society and what kind of policies that different parties might have. And I'm not advocating for one party over another at all at this point. I'm just saying it's an issue that we can all have an impact on collectively.
Frederick, let's go big now. Which countries and which emitters should we worry most about when we look at whether or not the world manages to achieve something close to net zero?
So obviously we have the really big emitters like the United States, like China, like India, like the European Union. And obviously we need to very closely look at what they do because they certainly determine the outcome. But that being said, I think it is very important also to consider that each and every country, like the UK, like Germany, etc., have a responsibility to be active. So it's also not a strategy to just say those big emitters need to get the job done. It's basically everyone sitting in the same boat and trying to find solutions together.
Sure. So, I mean, I agree with Frederick that, you know, it is the likes of the United States, China and India, those countries that have got very large production bases for goods that make it around the world. They're the ones that we need to really think about it on a global basis. We need to support them, actually. So it's not just worrying about them. What can we do to support them? And that is by being selective about which goods, for example, we're going to import and putting pressure on them to make the changes that I think are needed for the world.
What will work in order to pressurise them to do that?
So, for example, being very careful about, I'm going to use the term embodied carbon. So if we could somehow have measured the amount of carbon that's been emitted as a result of making a particular product and then have that available at the point of purchase, then we can determine which products that we would like to purchase. And we've seen it before, not with embodied carbon, but with the amount of energy that's used by a certain piece of equipment. So the White Goods Labelling Directive that was imposed by the European Union came into force about 2003, was then ratified by various countries. As a result of just providing the information to consumers at the point of purchase, so in addition to brand and price, you then had the energy rating, we all made collectively a decision to go and buy the more energy efficient machines and rendered the inefficient machines unsaleable by those manufacturers. And we changed the industry. We did.
I'm going to put what may seem a very difficult point to you, but I know it's something that you all will have been discussing, which is even if we do manage to hit our net zero targets by the date that we plan to, is it enough?
I don't think it is, unfortunately. And the reason being is that there's a secret, really, that is not a secret. It's the International Panel for Climate Change looking at the 1.5 target, for example. Right now, there is no scenario that is being considered that keeps us below 1.5 degrees centigrade. There is one scenario that gets us to 1.5 degrees centigrade by the end of the century, but we actually sail through that target mid-century and then somehow magically dip down below it. So I think we need to be exploring options to not only increase the rate of change of the economy to basically bring net zero sooner rather than later, because that will help a lot, but also explore potentially some other options, which we don't have at the moment. There's a field called geoengineering, which is incredibly controversial. For example, recreating some natural events. So when we have clouds forming over the ocean, they don't happen over certain areas of the ocean very often, but when they do happen, it's because ships have moved through there. And as a result of the particles emitting from a ship's funnel, they end up creating cloud banks. And those clouds could be nice and white and reflect some of the sun's radiation back to space. So we need to be looking at, well, is this a kind of process that we might want to go and devise an engineering scheme so that we can do this sort of thing?
Frederick.
Yeah, I just wanted to add also the perspective of where we are heading at the moment, right? So when we as the Climate Action Tracker look at currently implemented policies and actions, right? So those where we as analysts can really see, yeah, this is a policy being legislated, being in place, we are on track towards 2.7 degree of global warming by the end of century, right? And that shows the order of magnitude of how far off we are. And we also run these scenarios considering that, for instance, all current pledges and targets, right? So even including perhaps those more vaguely formulated net zero targets from Turkey or Saudi Arabia. And even if all those are considered, we are only getting closer to 1.8 degrees, so closely below 2. And that is with all uncertainty still existing.
I want to be absolutely clear about this. We currently are experiencing 1.2 degrees of warming since the beginning of the industrial era. And that is having the effect of increasing the chances of things like extreme weather events significantly. At 1.5, one imagines that those events will be happening even more. And at 1.8, they're going to be, I was going to use the term baked in, but that hardly seems a good phrase to use. It all sounds vaguely disheartening, Sean.
So if we carry on our current trajectory, then yes, it is disheartening. But I don't believe that that is the only course open to us. I do believe that if we work harder collectively together to increase the pace of change and therefore bring global net zero sooner rather than later, then things will be better. I'm not going to say that they're going to be good, but better. And then secondly, I actually do think we should be exploring some options so that we can at least ameliorate the effects of climate change whilst we get our climate in order and with carbon dioxide levels back down to something like 350 parts per million.
This is where we came in a way. Neither of you are politicians, but we've had discussion in this country in the last couple of weeks about whether or not net zero targets should be attempted in the current strategy because they may be politically unpopular. Frederick, in general, how worried are people working in the field that politics may run against the achievement of these necessary goals, let alone going beyond them?
I would say very much so, right? So for instance, we as the Climate Action Tracker, right, we assess 42 countries around the world and we look at very great detail of what is happening and what do countries propose. And it is simply, in sum, not adequate to address it. And there have been positive developments, there has been incremental change, but we are still yet to see that the actions match the order of magnitude that this threat of climate change poses to mankind. And for instance, when we speak about these net zero targets, these longer term visions, right, we still see many countries formulating them in very vague terms and not really taking up sort of this challenge to define how does a zero emission society actually look like, right? And by what time do we want to achieve that? So we have countries like New Zealand that exclude large chunks of their methane emissions, for instance, from agriculture and waste under their 2050 targets. We have the US that excludes international aviation and shipping under their targets. Switzerland relies on an unspecified amount of international offsets, so not even outlining specifically what they want to reduce domestically. And looking at this in total, it is indeed very worrying because we see that at the moment, policymakers across the world, they are either not in a position or not willing or in a combination to really adjust to that situation and to the context that we're currently facing.
Frederick Hance there with Sean Fitzgerald. My thanks to them and to Attractor Mooney and Gemma Connor. The Briefing Room will be back next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Claire Bowes. The editor was China Collins and the programme was mixed by James Beard.
You know the problem with technology, right? We've made it too complicated. I mean, it's filled with jargon and buzzwords and really it doesn't need to be. So I am going to fix it. Understand Tech and AI is a new series from BBC Radio 4 with me, Spencer Kelly. I've got together some great guests to help me explain everything from getting online to avoiding the artificial intelligence apocalypse. So, I'll see you there. Subscribe to Understand on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.